Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you on PopDose.com, doing a little talking about some of the things that you'll see elsewhere on PopDose, and a few of the things that just we like to kick around here on a weekly basis and have some fun with. So thank you so much for listening to us banter about it. And Rob, how's everything going this week?
So far, not bad.
Good.
So I'm happy to report... So far, not bad.
which is the best we can hope for. And there's a bunch to go over this week. And one of them I want to jump right into, even though it was kind of the last thing that we thought of for the show this week, is that one of my favorite singer-songwriters of all time is now finally recognized by the crown of his home country in Great Britain. Who got knighted?
Raymond Douglas Davies of the Kinks.
Finally.
Which, you know, I have to say... he deserved recognition, understatement of the year, I'm sure. Not just to be knighted, but frankly, he should have been named Poet Laureate years ago.
Yeah.
And I do mean years ago, because no one has been able to capture, and this is just my opinion, the essence, the feeling, the thought, the speak of the, and I'm going to use it in quotation marks, and this is not meant as a slant or anything on anyone, the average Briton,
right?
Over the last five decades, you know, when the Kinks started, of course, it was that almost tone deaf teenage punkness of things like "You Really Got Me" and "All Day and All of the Night" and "Tired of Waiting" and "Set Me Free" and "Who's Going to Be the Next in Line." But the minute he flipped the switch with one of the most important and one of the finest pieces of lyricism anyone will ever attempt, with a well-respected man,
yeah,
the game changed. And the game changed for everyone. I really feel like everyone should have been trying to up their game to compete with somebody like Ray Davies, who is such a great social observer, critic, satirist.
Right, and it's such a tough thing to kind of balance as a songwriter, because you had guys out there, you had The Who, you had The Beatles, you had The Stones, who were defining and reflecting a movement. And I think, to some degree, The Who wrote about that movement better than any of the other ones did, but they were paying attention to a particular segment of British society, namely the mods and the rockers of the teenage years at that point. Where
you
Ray
just
Davies
hit it right there.
Yeah,
you've hit it right there. A fragment of the population.
Yep.
The youthful frustration, and plus Pete Townsend, as incredible as a lyricist as he is and was then, he was being more reflective. It was more of a reflection of his take on what was in front of him.
Right.
Ray Davies was an overall, a reporter, if you will, for everyone.
Yeah.
And young and old.
Right. And you had well-respected man. You had a dedicated follower of fashion. You had the entire Village Green Preservation Society album. I mean, it was there as a through line alongside the punky stuff and later on the dance music with Come Dancing in the 80s. I mean, he dabbled in everything, but he found his niche there.
Exactly. I mean, look at just to throw out some of the examples, as you had said, well-respected man, dedicated follower of fashion. But then look at an album like, well, let's go with Face to Face, which many people have often said was actually the first concept album. I'm not so sure, but still, you know, just some of the observations on some of the lesser known songs like I'm an English Boy on a Holiday in Waikiki, you know,
right.
Be a complete fish out of water, no pun intended. But then on that album is also Sunny Afternoon and the follow-up single Dead End Street, or the flip side of Dead End Street, which I believe is Big Black Smoke, which is a very dark take on a runaway in London. You know, but then go to something like Something Else by the Kinks, which has David Watts, two sisters, which I think is one of Ray Davies' finest moments, without a doubt. Just read the lyrics, never mind listening to it, read the lyrics. A song like Situation Vacant. How jolly can you make a song about being unemployed?
Right,
you
know? And he did that in his own industry as well, because if you listen, a good probably 30 or 40% of the songs that are on Lola versus Power Man and the Money Go Round are about being in the seedy, awful, getting worse by the minute filth and muck of the record industry.
Which hasn't changed one iota since that album was done in 1970.
Right.
So now we're 40, 7 years in, and what's different about it now?
Yeah.
Somebody tell me. But still, Ray Davies has always been this incredibly gifted lyrical painter.
Right.
And it just always struck me that he should have been named Poet Laureate. That always, to me, was the mantle that he deserved, and rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
Now that he's
mm-hmm.
getting his due as being Sir Raymond Davies is wonderful, but it's almost like an afterthought. I'm happy for him, and I'm very pleased for him, and, you know, congratulations to him, but still, he's so much more than just being a knight, because
yeah.
he's given a voice to people that didn't really have a voice, and he gave them a musical voice besides a lyrical voice.
No doubt about it. So again, congratulations to Ray Davies, and there should be more honors coming, so we'll keep an eye out for that. We've got a bunch of new music to talk about this week. Want to jump into some of that, because you yourself have a couple of reviews up online at Popdos this week that bear some talking about, not the least of which is the Feelies. We've been talking about the Feelies for the last 3 or 4 episodes of the Radio City podcast, and now there's a world premiere video that's also featured on Popdos. What is it?
Yes, indeed, the track Gone, 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 which is one of the best songs on the album. The great thing about this latest record is that it's all good.
Yep,
There are no tracks that are of a lesser nature. But this one happens to be one of those, I know it's a horrible thing to say, but it's in that Feelies vein, but because it has that familiarity, that texture that the Feelies do so well. But at the same time, it's really catchy. And what's great is the fact that you don't need to be distracted by the, quote, visuals. It's a very straightforward video. Just let yourself get absorbed into the song while watching it, because it has that kind of hypnotic vibe to it.
See you later on.
I'm going to make a really weird kind of out there comparison. It's not even a comparison. It's just a note, because my wife and I were out this week and the song Happy, the Pharrell Williams song, came on. And I realized something about that song that had never hit me before. It has no bridge. It's verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. We're done here. It's a good song, but it struck me that it didn't have a bridge. This song, Gone, 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 not only does it have a bridge, it's one of my favorite devices that you used to hear a lot of, and it seems to have gone away, which is a musical bridge. There's no lyrics in that part of the song, but it's a musical bridge that really hits hard, and it goes away and comes back perfectly from the rest of the tune.
Which is, it's a lost art,
yep.
is what it's become. We used to try that device a bit on a couple of our songs. I'm not sure it ever worked, because there were songs that were never recorded, but you know, in my memory, if you will, they worked as part of the song.
Yeah.
And certainly we would always do these songs. So, you know, it always was a, let's put it this way, couldn't write a lyric, just play the music that you'd written for it.
Right.
You know, it works. And if you couldn't come up with a guitar solo for that spot, okay, that's a good way to do a bridge and or a middle eight. So either way, the interesting thing, though, is, and you bring up a really good point in terms of songwriting, it's not an easy thing to do, and it has gone away. The Feelies, of course, are, oh, here it comes, old school.
Yep.
But at the same time, it isn't as easy as one would think to just write verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, no bridge.
Right.
Not an easy feat. You know, I still write in the traditional manner. Verse, verse, bridge, chorus, verse. Maybe if I want it to be a lengthy song, verse, you know, do it all again, middle eight, repeat chorus. Or just, you know, verse, middle eight, change the middle eight, you know, lyrically, chorus. And then go to a middle eight. But it does take some deft songwriting skill to be able to approximate that just so it doesn't come out lumpy and clumsy.
Exactly. So all the more reason, and again, talented singer-songwriters, so go check out the new Feelies video for Gone, Gone, Gone. It's elsewhere on popdos.com. John Grayson and Rob Ross here with you, talking over some of the latest. We also are introduced to a young lady by the name of Cindy Lee Berryhill with a very weird tune, but still, I like the kind of out-there nature of it. Tell us about her and about her new album.
Well, she's been around for a while. She was, I would dare say, somewhat unfairly lumped in with that almost post-punk, and I'm saying very late post-punk, because her first records came out at, I believe, the middle to late part of the 80s.
Okay.
That whole newish group of female singer-songwriters that had an edge to them. And I've always thought she was far more skilled and a much more... She was a much more poetic, there you go again, lyricist than given credit for. Now, her career really hasn't exploded the way it deserved to be, but you know what, sometimes that's fine. The adulation and accolades aside, you know, she's a great singer and songwriter, and she hasn't done an album in about 10 years. There is a story behind it. I don't know if we really want to get into the depth of it, but it's her new album, The Adventurist, is a tribute to her husband, who passed away during that period. Her husband was the legendary and famed rock writer Paul Williams, the man who founded Crawdaddy. And it was a very long and protracted situation that they were in, and he passed a few years ago, and now she's back.
Good.
And The Adventurist is a very subtle tribute and chronicle of her life at the end of that painful scenario and how she's gone on since then.
Dogs don't like everybody. They'll scare you away, then become your best buddy. Expecting the worst, sappy and nice. Dig through your purse and they're a friend for life. You like dogs. You like dogs.
It's very subtle. It doesn't beat you over the head. And that's what makes this album work so well.
Yep.
It's universal themes. Yes, she's drawing from personal experience, but it's a universal theme that we can all relate to. Any form of tragedy,
yeah,
you can understand.
And the playing and singing is interesting. It's, you know, again, it's her own style. And she, because the album is what it is, as you said, it's a tribute, she can do whatever she wants. So it feels like she's very comfortable with these songs.
She is, and it doesn't hurt that the people that are on this record have a skill and a knowledge and a precision. Robin Gregory and Nelson Bragg are both from Brian Wilson's band.
Oh, okay. Very good. And,
you know, this music at points does take a very Wilson-esque turn when you talk about the construction of the actual songs, the melodies, let alone the lyricism. But the thing is, it's a highly emotional record. Even if you don't know anything about the backstory, let's just say for argument's sake, there's still an immediate sense of this will grip at your heart, because it's meant to do that. It's a personal record. I mean, I think every album anybody does should be a personal statement, obviously.
Yep, right.
Because then why are you doing it? But there are some people who can deliver an album that immediately has that kind of draw to it. You know, there are those albums that you'll listen to once and you may not get it, but the second or third or fourth or even eighth listen, something will click.
Yeah.
This is not one of those. This you immediately feel.
Exactly, and it's wonderful. So go check it out. Again, there's a video over there for you on the page and a little bit more behind the music online at popdose.com. From Rob Ross, it's the album review of Cindy Lee Berryhill's The Adventurist. We also have new music coming out this week from Kelly Ryan. This is another one that is a singer-songwriter. She has a lot of fun, I think, going off in different directions with her own music. So tell us a little bit about what we have in Telescope.
Well, here's the good thing. First of all, this is her first time that she's really, I guess, she's letting it all, dare I say it, all out. You know, she's really going for it on this record. And you can tell, fun, excitement, exuberance, a lot to say. You know, there's some, I mean, just to give you some of the lyrics, you know, lay me like a rag doll on the ground, golden boy of ecstasy, burn me down. Yowza. You know?
Right, right.
That's, you know, that's going to give you pause to think. But the fun factor is also, I think, in who appears on this record with her. Just to name drop for you on this one, Don Dixon and Marty Jones, Marshall Crenshaw. How's that for three?
Not bad.
Help me out. I fall for the flowers.
resist and shout with roses in my eyes. Every voice inside my head tells me I am left for dead without a doubt.
That's another key component to all of this. The most important thing is that there is a lot of melody. There is a lot of on-the-one traditional structure, what we were talking about as far as songwriting goes.
Yeah.
She's got a great voice. She knows how to deliver, and I mean deliver, the song.
She knows when to hit hard and when to lay back.
I was just about to say the natural vibe of the song.
Yep.
You know, what you
yep.
and I always talk about and look for. Are they pushing it? Are they forcing it? Are they trying to go into a territory that they shouldn't be? None of that could be found on this record.
Yeah. And the,
period.
You know, in the video too, the one that's linked on the page alongside the review, the one for Crack in the Sky, is a bizarre little piece of cinematography. And yet, you know, again, if your thing is just to sit there and listen to the song while something visually interesting is going on, definitely want to click on this one.
Well, I say not only click on it, but go look for the album, because
yeah.
it's a good one.
Good.
It's a solid one.
Yep.
And that's the key thing. It's solid. And that's what you want. You want to get a whole package. You don't want to just go, well, one or two tracks were good.
Right.
You want the whole thing.
Well, and when you've got somebody who in her press photo is holding a Dan Electro U2, things could definitely be worse. So good for her. Kelly Ryan, the brand new one is called Telescope. And again, the review is up for you online at popdose.com. Rob Ross and John Grayson sitting here talking a little bit about it this week. And we've got a little bit more music to talk about. But we're going to take a turn into Ken Shane's column, because you and I have both grown more and more affection over time for Ken Shane and what he does in Soul Serenade. So tell us what we have this week.
Well, he's right in my wheelhouse this week, of course, because he picked one of my favorite singles from the Stax, from what I would consider the Stax, you know, funk era, or if I'm being really, really nitpickish, as I usually get about Stax, we're talking the yellow label Snapping Finger era.
Right.
You know, the post-Atlantic years, the Gulf Western, Famous Music, independent, then CBS destroyed era. But one of my favorite songs from when I was a kid was Private Number by William Bell, the great William Bell, who is now back on Stax after all these years,
yeah.
and the late Judy Clay. And she never really got her due. I mean, this was the biggest hit I think she was ever going to have. But still, you know, he did single, no pun intended, he singled this one out. It is one of the all-time truly greats. It is a powerful, slow jam, heartrending, stays with you for the rest of your life from the minute you've heard it. And I remember hearing it, just to give you the little background,
yeah.
on a compilation when I was about, I don't know, 10 or 11. Granted, it was a couple of years after it had come out, but it was a compilation called, I think it's called Stax's Greatest Hits, or Stax's 20 Greatest Hits. And this came right on after the theme from Shaft. So what a lead-in, you
yeah.
know, to pick up on a track, you know?
Right.
I think, it was the opening two tracks on side one, and then side two opened with, of course, Time is Tight, which is probably my number three favorite all-time song in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, but anyway, William Bell, Judy Clay, Private Number, Stax Records, read Ken's column, get the backstory, then keep reading Ken's column. You'll
exactly.
get an education.
Welcome home. Nothing's wrong.
Yeah. You know, and I wouldn't say this about all of them, but I would about this one. If you don't know the song at all, if this is your first introduction to it, then listen to the song first and then read the column, because this one, it's the story of a guy who feels like, even though the term wouldn't be invented for another 45 years, he feels like he's being ghosted. And then the song takes a turn, and that's all I'm going to say about it. But the cool thing about this song is you mentioned the Stax pedigree, and it's all the way through this, not only with him, but also with the fact that he co-wrote this song with Booker T.
And of course, let's put it this way. I mean, I know this column is more geared towards Judy Clay, but William Bell also put out one of the first truly giant songs of the Stax imprint back in the 60s. He did the original version of You Don't Miss Your Water.
Right.
So I don't think, between those two songs, that's legend cemented.
Right. So there's all the more reason to go check this one out. But again, listen to the song, then read the entire column, and you'll learn a lot about what's going on here. And again, Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you. You're listening into Radio City. We've got a couple more things to go over, and there's another Rob, as a matter of fact. This time, Rob Smith, who also writes for Popdos, who caught your eye this week with a column about a guy whose voice, we just couldn't get enough of back in the day. What did he write about?
He wrote about Dave Bickler, who was the original lead singer for the band Survivor and was the voice of Eye of the Tiger. What I found so intriguing about Rob's column and so good about it is what I took from it, as far as you hear a song, you hear a voice in particular that always triggers a memory. And the depth of the writing about that is what really, really, it was very touching, because it reminded me of a lot of people that, once upon a time, if I heard the voice, I was immediately catapulted back to that time and the memories that are aligned with it,
right.
Which I think happened. I hate to say it. It is a very true cliche. As we get older, it's far more frequent.
Yep.
Here's one particular song, because after Eye of the Tiger, I don't believe Survivor had too many more hits with Mr. Bickler on lead vocals.
Right.
They changed over to, I think his name was Jimmy Jamerson, and then they started to have a massive run of hits. But nevertheless, you are immediately brought back to a certain time and place and moment, and there's a sense of comfort and familiarity, more the comfort, I think, and a really warm emotion. And that's what this column is about. It's a very emotional column. If you don't have to read between the lines, just read what Rob is saying. And the fact that he goes to thank Dave Bickler for those memories, I think, is such a powerful thing. And it really makes you actually want to go back and listen to it and try to understand the how and why he was affected by this.
Yeah.
Because I think it gives a greater depth to it, 82, I couldn't identify with it because, I was in my stupid, myopic, I won't say stupid, but I was definitely in that myopic punk rock mentality, or, punk rock new wave, carrying that torch against all that was bloated rock or
corporate.
Heinous dance music,
yeah.
Right, or corporate rock, but nevertheless, I can understand the feeling, because certainly, let's say for argument's sake, I hear the opening drums to When I Dream by The Teardrop Explodes. I will guarantee you that within 30 seconds, tears will well up in my eyes.
Yeah.
Because that's how I get when I hear certain elements of songs, or just certain songs, never mind hearing the voice. I'm sure if I heard Julian Cope's voice, that the youthful Julian Cope, especially on something like the opening lines of Passionate Friend, where it just starts. It doesn't even have an intro. It's just, the friend I have is a passionate friend. I'm going to start bawling.
Right. Well, and it's funny, too. I mean, there's so many stories about these things. And as you said, Rob's column is not so much about the song itself as it is about that feeling. But that one in particular, we had a conversation, probably about 3-4 years ago, with the guy who wrote Eye of the Tiger, Jim Peterick, who, of course, came from Ides of March originally, who did Vehicle. And he said, there's always that wonder when you have a song that's so closely associated with a movie, as that one was with, was it Rocky III, I think?
Yes.
And so you always wonder, okay, so did the song, which came first? You know, did they pick the song for the movie or did they write the song for the movie? And in that case, they wrote the song. He was contacted by Sylvester Stallone to write a song for the movie, and that's where Eye of the Tiger came from. So there's an interesting story behind it that I won't, you know, because of time constraints, we won't go fully into. But if you ever get the chance, he's a guy who's done a lot of writing, Peterik has, about his own music, and it's worth checking out a little bit more information about that song.
Well, if I remember correctly, you sent me a copy of the book, so I think I have
That's
it.
That's right. and the story is in there, so definitely check that one out. Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you, but again, check out Rob Smith's column this week on Eye of the Tiger and on Mr. Bickler and his voice and all that it meant. So that's there for you elsewhere. We've got a couple more things to talk about. We're going to get into some of the current events, but before we do, we started this feature a few weeks ago called In Our Heads, and this time around, it's just about whatever happened to be there, you know, sort of front and center musically or whatever throughout the course of this week. And in riding around in my car, because I have a much longer commute now than I used to, I listen to a little bit of music, and most of the time it's my phone that picks the music for me. And it happened to play two songs back to back that were both about smuggling, about drug running. And that, you know, it seemed to kind of stick with me over the course of this week, and I was thinking about a few more of them. But the first one, and I'm only going to tell you the first one that it played now, because then, Rob, I want to hit you with this and see what you've got for us. But the first came from one of my favorite sort of underground singer-songwriters, Roger Klein, of the Peacemakers, who, about 10 years ago, they put out an album called No More Beautiful World, and there's a song on there called Contraband. And it just so happens that it came from a conversation that he had in Mexico with a bunch of guys that he happened to run into who were all smugglers. So out of that conversation grew this song Contraband. And, you know, it gives such a great feel for what it is to be in that life and all of the payoffs and everything that goes on. And still, you know, they have to worry about the law coming across them. And, you know, it's an interesting insight, but it's a very fun, happy, upbeat kind of song about something that's one of the more nefarious influences on society right now.
Show this sea outruns 200 kilometers wide. Keep your eyes peeled, head down, hands steady, throttle ready to run, then nowhere to hide. The machete, the silence, and the darkness are my friends. Yeah, I know I got a day with fate. I know not where or when, but I provide a little seed, little known on my homegrown service to society. I've got your spies at a verified price now. Choose your variety. Contraband, I will be there, dark and not a light of day. A guaranteed delivery by air, by sea or land. That's how I make a lot of ease of money, baby. We'll make a lot of ease of money, baby. Come on, make a lot of ease of money, baby. The hard way.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that and funny in its own wry way is the fact that it reminds me so much, and I immediately can visualize it, of Glenn Frey telling the story of how they'd written Life in the Fast Lane, because never mind the fact that Joe Walsh had the riff as a finger exercise, if you remember correctly, because that's all that was, but he was in a car with a drug dealer going about 90 miles an hour. And the guy just looks at him, grins, and says, "Life in the fast lane, baby."
Right.
And, you know, I don't know that I can glorify or digest the whole thing, but I certainly understand it, especially taken in the context of the time, you know, rich rock star of the 70s in probably at that moment the biggest band in the world.
Yep.
And, you know, what more can you say than that? I certainly don't I don't condone it, but, you know, I understand it. I understand where stories come from.
Yeah, and there's something about that. I mean, going back to Mr. Klein, I mean, he was the guy that was the lead singer and songwriter for the Refreshments, and their song Banditos is about pulling a bank job south of the border. So that idea of writing songs around heists, writing songs around crime stories, there's so many of them out there and so many great ones. So, I mean, is there one that resonates with you?
Well, Life in the Fast Lane is definitely one.
Yeah.
Going along with that, Smuggler's Blues.
Right.
How can you ever forget that? I mean, God knows it was really cheesy. But, you know, what makes this an interesting conversation and the turn that we're going to take on it is the fact that I remember as a teenager, especially in those formative years as a budding or wanting songwriter and musician, to try and find inspiration. And I remember how many times I would hear about songs that were written under the influence. Now, here's a true confession moment. You know, I never really dabbled that much with any kind of mind-altering chemicals,
yeah.
Truth be told. I mean, the most I ever did was about 1985, 86, I smoked a lot of pot. That was about it. You know, I think I drank in an equal amount. And by the end of 86, I kid you not, it was over and done with both, you know,
right.
Because it just wasn't interesting anymore. I was lucky. I was one of the lucky ones that didn't see, okay, you know what, I've done this and now it doesn't do anything for me. The key thing about this is people talking about, you know, the inspiration that they found under the influence. You know, look at the things that the Beatles were able to do. Look at the things that the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, all these, you know, Donovan, all these amazing, amazing things that people wrote and did under the influence of drugs. Guess what? It's a lie and it's a myth. And the reason I say it's a lie and a myth is because it's not truth. You
right.
know, yeah, you might be able to write some great lyrics and so on and so forth. Okay, maybe Strawberry Fields Forever was the result of post-lysergic experience, but you know, half the stuff on Sgt. Pepper is absolute lyrical garbage.
Yeah.
The fact is, when you're in an altered state, it isn't your truth coming out. It's
right.
complete and utter. It's just bullshit is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not trying to be some kind of moral compass or pompous windbag, you know, getting on on one of those platitudes, but it's just the fact that if you can't write as yourself because you're sitting down to write, because you're trying to get a thought, a feeling, an emotion, a political statement out, you're not going to be able to do it successfully and coherently if you're fucked up.
Exactly. And you look at the people who didn't. And see, that's where I think you look for the lie, is you look for the people who stayed straight the entire time. So they say, but yeah, I mean, we have nothing but their words to go by. And if Frank Zappa can write that shit straight, anybody can.
You know, I mean, listen, how many of the bands that I love were all on drugs? All of them.
Right. Sure.
I mean, that's the fact. But you know, you have to have some sense of not being under an influence to be able to actually remember what you wanted to write.
Yep.
And get it out and have it make some sense.
Right, and execute it, sure. It's an excuse, I think. It's one of those things where, you know, the artist needs me, right? So it's one of those things that they say to themselves to justify their own behavior. And I, you know, what I say is, look, if you're in that position and you want to bend your mind, go ahead. But then don't tell me that's where the music came from. I don't buy it.
Right, because you have to have that absolute talent anyway.
Yep.
You're not going to go to bed one night or take a hit of acid, I don't think. I mean, I don't know, but
yeah.
I don't think you're going to take a hit of acid and suddenly come up with a guitar riff that blossoms into Purple Haze. I'm sorry, it just doesn't go that. You were already playing something, and you hit upon the right notes and the right texture and timbre and timing and everything. You know,
yeah.
It just, I'm not a believer in that because it doesn't translate.
Yeah.
Incoherence and chemically altered does not translate well into a finished piece that will be looked upon and cherished by all. It just doesn't jive with me. I mean, it's
no.
funny because this morning we were listening to the radio and Sunny Gooch Street by Donovan came on. And I was thinking not about that song, but I was thinking about the Fat Angel. You know, with its insufferably cosmic, the master of the cosmic wheels, of course.
Right.
It's just so insufferably cosmic with that whole, that refrain of, you know, fly Translove Airways, get you there on time. And then it goes into fly Jefferson Airplane, get you there on time. It's like, dude, you're an incessant name dropper. I love you. You're a hero of mine. You're one of my favorite singer-songwriters. But God, do you always have to drop names in these fucking songs?
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. You know? But everything with Donovan, man, is just so, I'm high.
Right, right. And at
I'm high.
At the same time, though, I can listen to Atlantis 40 times in a row and never get bored with it. So, yeah, I know what you mean. But the other song, and it just kind of bring this whole thing full circle, the song that my iPod decided, or my phone rather, decided to follow up Roger Klein's Contraband with is one of my favorite Stephen Stills cuts, Treetop Flyer. And that one, again, it's a very different take on that same story, but you feel like you're there.
You know, those songs, there has to be some semblance of, I'm going to say, truth to those, because I want to say this to discount what we've just been talking about.
Yeah.
But these narratives about the drug running experience, you know, certainly that might have been just, you know, I don't think for one moment that Stephen Stills was in a plane with somebody, you know, coming down over a pot field or something, or trying to score, you know what I mean?
Although you never know.
I mean, Fry was there with the dealer.
Exactly.
And he was open about it. But I think the thing is that those were narratives. You know what I mean? They were at least they were able to tell a story from somebody else's perspective,
yep.
Perhaps. You know, you're talking to someone, you know, you're telling me a story about, I don't know, some experience you had back in 1987 at a show, and it was just this pivotal moment that happened at the show. And I, in turn, will turn that into a story, a lyrical content of a song, because the inspiration was your story.
Right.
I think that's enough of the criteria that you could work with.
Without doubt.
I would hope.
So, yeah, and there's so many others. You mentioned Smuggler's Blues, and, I mean, there's the great heist songs like Banditos and like Take the Money and Run. I mean, crime has been a wonderful, even I Shot the Sheriff. It's been such a wonderful place to start when you're building
and
those
of
kinds
course,
of narratives.
Let's not forget High, High, High by Wings.
You
can't get
right.
more blatant than that.
Right, and Wanderlust, also Paul McCartney talking about a drug bust going bad, or a drug deal going bad. One that I think that did come from a true story. Isn't that the one that almost landed him in prison for a while?
Well, Wanderlust came out on Tug of War in 82, which was 2 years after the bust in Japan.
Right, right. So, yeah, I'm pretty
maybe
sure.
Maybe it is a recounting. Maybe it's a recounting of it.
Yep.
All I remember is, you know, I was what? Seven,
yeah,
eight. When High, High, High came out,
uh-huh.
And you know, I'm gonna do you, Sweet Banana. You never. It's one of two things. Either it's a song about we gonna get high, 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 or we're gonna fuck.
Exactly. And, or again, maybe both.
Or both.
Yeah, very cool. So, you know, we'll look forward in your comments in the comments section on this article, by the way. If you've got some more to toss at us that are among your favorite crime-related tunes, then by all means do that, and we'll keep track throughout the course of this week. But as we look forward to another week of just, you know, the government falling apart at the seams, so that's fun. Now we have General Flynn, who's looking for immunity. This is the same guy who said anybody looking for immunity probably did it. So now he's looking for an immunity deal to testify, and he says he's got a great story to tell. You know, it's weird. It's been, what, not even 3 months now, and all I can do is think back to what life must have been like in 1972, 1973, 1974, never really knowing. Because the one thing that strikes me about all of this is I have no idea where we are in terms of the wheels falling off of this administration. I know they're going to fall off, but people say, oh, he'll be done in a couple of weeks, or he'll last another year. I have no way to gauge how far it's gone at this moment.
Flynn, the man who was behind Pizzagate, and now he wants immunity, and it doesn't look like he's going to get that immunity.
Right.
Too fucking bad.
Yeah, aw, poor guy.
I want to address what you just said, because that's a very, very important thing to try and remember, because I was eight when Watergate started,
mm-hmm.
and it just started as kind of a rumble, if you will.
Yeah.
I remember with as much clarity as possible around mid to late 73 was when the news started becoming a lot more ominous, and when we would have current events in school, because that was around the time that you would do current events, starting in the second grade.
Yep.
You started to see and by on your own bring in articles about investigations into the federal government and what exactly is Watergate? Where is Watergate? That coupled with, of course, the idea that the troops would finally be coming home from Vietnam. So both were on the table. And then I remember, and you might have to look this up just to corroborate me on this one. I think it was the end of 73 when Spiro Agnew resigned as vice president. And then you knew the shit was really hitting the fan. And then I remember hearing the names over and over and over again. They were all inseparable. Haldeman, Mitchell.
Ehrlichman.
Ehrlichman, Dean.
Yep.
And of course, and Kissinger was also, you know, part of it. And Nixon. And those names just became completely synonymous. And that's when I became aware of who Woodward and Bernstein were.
Right.
And I started to actively sit up and take... So you go from being an 8-year-old to a 9-year-old, and suddenly your eyes are opening, and you're watching this thing unfold, and then, you know, somebody like Gerald Ford is suddenly named the new vice president, which hadn't been done before. And I remember my parents talking about him because he had been part of the Warren Commission.
Right.
And they didn't... They thought this was even more sinister, and I got to give complete credit to my father. My father loved Richard Nixon. My father was a Republican, but he hated Ford, and at this point, he was so angered by Nixon for being the hypocrite that he seemingly was, and he couldn't wait to see, you know, what would be that one smoking gun.
Right. And you were, by the way, you were dead on right. October 10th, 1973 is when Agnew resigned. So you have the time frame precise. And that's it. It's just that, you know, in that case, you had two things that we don't have here yet. And you nailed them both. You had the smoking gun. And, I mean, there was the story. There was the actual narrative of what happened, what the law was that was broken. It was clear, or it became clear. The other thing you had then that we don't have yet is a press that you could rely on. Who's Woodward and who's Bernstein now?
The question there is open-ended, because let's look back at what they did and how they went about doing it. Now, I will grant you, all it was a disgruntled agent who had gotten passed over.
Right.
The guy who brought down an entire government. That's a story. It's actually kind of deflating and disillusioning in and of itself, because you would have thought that it was somebody who just wanted to see the right thing done.
Yep.
That was what we all, I think, hoped for.
Right.
And it was just a sourpuss. And that just really, really makes it, it doesn't make him a hero. It makes him as big of a dick as the rest were.
Yeah.
Having said that, look at what Bernstein and Woodward worked with back then. You know, these secretive meetings, you know, very cloak and dagger.
Right.
They had to do a lot of very dangerous research. You couldn't tell back then if you were being followed or tracked, unless you were so paranoid that you would sit up and take turns watching to make sure that you weren't being followed or tracked. You know, they did the physical legwork and research.
Right.
Anywhere and everywhere they could. They spoke to people. Right now, the press is just busy patting themselves either on the back for their attempts at trying to take down this presidency, or I'm not even sure what they're really trying to do, just to make him look bad or look foolish, because they love the back and forth and the childish tit-for-tat playground games that are going on right now.
Yeah.
The problem is I look at the press, frankly, as being as credible as the Trump government is. I find them being completely, I'm sorry if I'm going to be offensive on this front, but I look at MSNBC as no different than Fox.
No.
All this nonsense and palaver about MSNBC is the arbiter of the left. No, well, you know what? The left is just as fucked up as the right. The left is just as insane as the right. This new left is no different than the Tea Party was, and nobody's going to tell me otherwise.
Exactly.
Stop and you listen and you have conversations with people who you think you can have a rational political discourse with, and they go off into that far left. It's almost like that far left, right on wanky politics of the early 70s, you know, the days of the Symbionese Liberation Army and John Lennon's bullshit and the whole right on, man, and, you know, being part of the underground and subversion and
'cause it's fun. Yeah. And that's what they never said. They didn't get into that shit because of beliefs. They got in because it's fun. And look what we get to be. We get to be the opposition, man. And hey, check us out. We're important. And it was all horseshit.
And you know what? They were all high, too.
Yeah, I know.
Doesn't help. mean, seriously, it was all about fucking drugs,
right,
you
right.
know?
Well,
I mean, these people were not exactly worried about your best interests or mine, you know? They didn't worry about the older people who, if their funds are cut, how are they going to survive medically or get food or anything? No, no, it was always about making themselves look good. You know, this whole thing with MSNBC, and you know, you and I talked about it last week, the Rachel Maddow thing with his taxes, it's
right.
horseshit.
Right.
All that is trying to draw people into an audience, you know. I can't listen to this stuff anymore because you haven't delivered anything substantial. And I think everybody else out there, you and the people that listen to us, we want facts. And that goes for anybody who's either Democrat or Republican. We just want facts because facts supersede everything.
Right.
Not speculation.
Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously, it's Meals on Wheels and PBS that are breaking this country, so we needed to get rid of those. I mean, it's so stupid, it's so insane. But I'm gonna turn things, and I'm gonna go again way out in left field, and then see if we can't bring this thing around. I made the case, and I still maintain that this is true, that the reason why you have the anti-vaxxer movement is because you have people who are too young to remember losing classmates to polio. And I'm one of them, by the way. I was too young for that. I know that it happened, but we never saw iron lungs. We never saw kids dying of rubella. I mean, everybody that was in my class when I was in kindergarten graduated high school. My mom didn't have that experience, you know? So the reason why that movement spread is because people were too young to remember. They didn't remember how bad it was. And I get this sneaking suspicion that we're in that same place now with politics. Nazis aren't real to us, you know? We don't get it. We don't understand what fascism was really about. We don't even understand really what the Stasi and all of that was about, because by the time most of us were really paying attention, it was long gone. It was in the history books. So now you've got an entire generation of people who were born after that, and they're voting. And they're voting stupidly because they don't understand what it is that they're dealing with. They don't know how dangerous it is, so they don't know how much they need to stay away from it.
You need to add one more thing to that list. This newfound cultural misappropriation
yep.
that this younger generation seems to align themselves with yeah. with such freewheeling
oh, yeah.
arrogance and irresponsibility. And you know what, in their own way, because they do it the way they do, they come off as more racist than anybody else.
Right.
No, and again, you want to talk about a fascist mentality? Well, that's what this new extreme left is.
Yep.
You know, and I, of course, am somebody who is, I would consider, left of center. Because I've always said, and I will always maintain this, on a fiscal level, especially as I've gotten older, of course I'm bound to be more conservative. But when it comes to, you know, basic social rights and justices, live and let live.
Yeah.
Period.
Right.
It's not a great stretch. You don't need to pontificate on it. But as you just said, they don't remember. None of them seem to remember. Let me ask you something. On your left arm, because that's where it was, and you're from New York anyway, do you still have a scar from a very faint one, but a scar from your original polio vaccination when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's still there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm 52. I still have it.
Yep.
So, yeah. We know what it's about, you know. We went through all the shots because that's what you did.
Right.
It's that simple. I also want to throw into something that you just said about that, because you're also having now people who are in the media, and I'm not going to name names because I don't want to give them any airtime on our program.
Yeah.
But them being these arbiters of knowledge for the anti-vaccination movement, these are fucking media gadflies.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're talking about. I don't take the words of a failed TV comedic personality.
Right.
Slash Playboy, you know, Playboy centerfold or whatever the fuck she was. I don't take that as anything important, really. That's about as meaningful as listening to the sage political advice of someone like Susan Sarandon.
Exactly, okay? Right.
It's more of nothingness, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the way that everybody goes around referring to, and I'm really sick of it, and you know why I'm particularly sick of hearing the word Nazi. No, these are not
right.
Nazis.
Right.
Okay?
And I think that's evidence of it, because the term is thrown around like a generic now. And I think the reason why that is because they think, oh, a Nazi is anybody who doesn't think the same way I do. And you can't do that. I hate it when that term gets, oh, look at this, the latest thing that Trump's doing. They're like a bunch of Nazis. No.
No.
No, they're not.
No. They were Nazis.
Yeah, right.
They were Nazis.
And that's the, it's, yeah, is what they're doing wrong? Is what they're doing bad? Is what they're doing hurting people? Absolutely. Are they Nazis? No.
Correct.
No.
No. Are they fascists? No. Are they assholes? Yes.
Yep.
Are they corrupt? Yes.
Right.
Are they completely clueless?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is what you've got to stick with. What little facts we have, and that's what brings it right back to what you were talking about. What little facts we have, you work with. But don't go bending about a title or a phrase or a slogan.
Yep.
Because all you're doing is just waving something convenient that idiots are going to latch onto. People love, especially the younger generation, a slogan they can latch onto.
Yeah.
You know what? Guess what? Stupid lives don't matter.
There you go. And you know, it also, from a selfish standpoint, when you start calling people Nazis and fascists and all of this, it makes you easy to dismiss. Hit people with knowledge. Hit people with facts. Don't hit them with slogans, because all it does is give you something that you can be knocked down easily with. And yeah, it doesn't help get you anywhere.
Well, you just said the magic words. Hit them with knowledge and with facts. And at the same time, speak to them.
Yep.
Don't shout at them. Don't browbeat them. Don't publicly shame them. You know, all of this shit is just that. It's shit. And if you want to come after me, go ahead. And
yep.
I say that in all seriousness.
Right.
Because I will give as good as I can get and then some, because at least I have the knowledge. I can back up the things that I say, because otherwise I wouldn't be stupid enough or irresponsible or arrogant enough to say them.
Here's,
you know?
Here's the way the game works. You know, you get into a discussion with somebody. They realize you're on the other side of the argument. They say something that a belligerent asshole would say. And then to raise the rhetoric, the reason why that's done is to get you, it's to bait you into doing the same thing and raise the level of the argument, turn the volume up, so that all you do is end up screaming with each other. The only thing you can do is if you realize that the person that you're having that discussion with is bound to be a belligerent asshole, walk away. They're not going to change their minds. You're wasting your time. Find the ones you can talk to, then have the discussion with them.
Right. Because the perfect place that you've seen it happen time and time and time and time again now is Facebook, because on social media,
right.
Everybody's an authority.
Exactly.
You know, everybody's an authority in a free forum.
Yeah, and you see it happen.
I'm raised Bob Mould here, you know. It's ridiculous. I remember some of the conversations, and I'm using the word conversations in quotation marks, conversations I had with people during the elections and the debates. You know, it was the bros versus the people who were supporting Hillary Clinton. One word sums them all up, male and female,
yep.
Because it's right across the board, myopic.
Right. Yeah. And one of the most cogent things that I heard said after the election, in that sort of reflective period where the Democrats were all going, what the fuck just happened? Is, and I wish I could give credit, I don't remember who said it, but somebody, and I think it was one of the guests on Bill Maher's show, said, our biggest mistake was making Mitt Romney into a monster. Mitt Romney wasn't a monster. This guy's a monster. But not when you call him a monster, they think, oh, you're just doing it again.
That's a fair point. That's a very fair point.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, this election, there's a lot of elements to it and surrounding it. But you know, look, I supported Hillary Clinton, but I can honestly say to you, was she the choice? If I had my druthers, no, certainly not.
Right.
It certainly wasn't Bernie Sanders.
You know? Right.
Not by any stretch of the fucking imagination, nor would he ever be. First of all, he isn't a Democrat. He has never been a Democrat. That is a fact.
Yep.
That is not anger. That is a fact, and I'm tired of that nonsense being thrown about. Hillary Clinton was just not a good candidate.
No.
She really wasn't. The playing field was very... Well, it was beyond limited. I mean, look, Martin O'Malley never even made it out of the chute, really. So
he had nothing to say, right?
Between him and somebody like Tim Kaine or Sherrod Brown, that's his name, right? Sherrod Brown,
yes.
From Ohio.
Uh-huh.
I hate to say it, but we need to keep going forward for the Democratic Party. I think the Democratic Party needs to keep going forward. And I'm going, and then this is not ageism, because I'm 52 and I don't have a hell of a lot of time left. But we need to keep going in a younger direction. I think that's what the party needs. We sort of started to get younger again once once Obama came in.
Right, and the one name that everybody keeps looking towards, and I think rightly so, because I think the guy could be a world beater if he puts his mind to it, is Cory Booker.
Cory Booker, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, sir. Absolutely. You know, I have friends who have lived and live in Newark before, during, and after his tenure as mayor there.
Yeah. Yep.
When he was mayor, no pun intended, it was like night and day. For the first time, Newark was truly someplace that you'd want to go and not, you wouldn't think about it. It's like, oh, wait a minute, Newark. And now it just seems to have fallen to ruin again. But the guy works his ass off.
Yep.
And I really, really resent those motherfuckers out there who were trying to smear his name over a whole thing about, you know, big pharmaceuticals and, oh, Booker's behind big pharma. Read the facts before you start saying this shit.
Right.
Okay?
But that's a campaign, though. I mean, that is an organized campaign, and it just shows that they're scared. So, yeah, I mean, the guy pulled people out of a burning building, for Christ's sake. So, yeah, I think he's definitely one to watch. There's a couple more, but they're not nearly as talented as he is. So,
and not as motivating or you don't get a feeling like you're being call to action,
right,
that you get from somebody like him. I mean, I got to give Obama credit, and Obama was not a great president. Let us not kid ourselves. He was certainly one of the worst presidents I've ever seen as far as foreign diplomacy goes.
Hell of a campaigner, though.
Thereof. Right. Hell of a campaigner. Hell of a, you know, let's face it, he really was a fantastic community organizer.
Right. Yeah.
But he did it on a national scale.
Exactly.
He was able to do it. Hillary Clinton could not galvanize people. Hillary Clinton was robotic. Hillary Clinton, even though she is the most qualified candidate I have ever seen in my life, if there was a blueprint for someone who should be president, it should be her. But you have to connect with people.
Yeah.
And you're not going to. And she did not connect with people.
No. And if you make the comparison, I think that the reason why, and it comes down to not just saying the words, but believing it, is that you go back to Kennedy, who is also an amazing campaigner. And what was everything? There was never an I statement. There was never, I'm going to do this for you. And I think Hillary did that. I think Donald Trump does nothing but that, because he's pretty sure he's the only person here. But you go back to Kennedy, we choose to do these things, not because they're easy, but because
right.
they are hard. Everything was us. And it was like the assumption was made that you're already on board. You're already one of us. So come on, let's get this thing done.
He had it. Kennedy had it.
Yep.
Bill Clinton had it.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton could identify. Bill Clinton was amazing to watch. He
yep.
really was. If he could have just kept himself together and kept his dick in
his pants
long
up.
Enough,
right.
He really could have been the greatest president you and I would ever see in our lifetime, because he was such a smart, learned, knowing individual. But he fucked it all up royally.
Exactly.
He really did, and got time wasted.
Yeah.
You know, at least 3 of the 4 years of his second administration were wasted. But there was a guy that knew how to campaign. He knew how to connect with. Look, he still does it.
Yeah.
He's not a president anymore. He's not a politician anymore. He's just a citizen. But he still connects with people.
Right.
Why is that? Because it's a gift, first of all. It has to come from you naturally.
Yep.
You know, it really, you can't, you don't learn it, you don't buy it, and you don't get it taught to you. And no matter what, and I'm sure Hillary Clinton is a lovely woman. I have heard actually nothing but good things about her as a person, away from, you know, the whole political limelight.
Right.
I've heard that she's a lovely, genuinely caring and concerned person. She wants to know you know, but as a campaigning candidate, she could not connect.
No.
And that was very clear.
And what I really want to see in 2020 is somebody that not only has that ability to connect, but also somebody who knows how to deal on a debate stage next to and with Donald Trump. And she clearly just could never get over the hump with that. So it's a long time off in the future. Of course, we'll have plenty of time to talk about campaign 2020 when we get into like 2019, maybe. But in the meantime, you know, again, there's all the more reason to keep your eyes open, watch what's going on, get involved in it, and just pay attention, and pay attention to who's lied to you in the past, because chances are they will lie to you in the future. And when you find the person who's telling you the truth, stick with them and or her, and just keep reading those words, keep paying attention to those things. You know, you look like Fareed Zakaria has never lied to me that I know of. You know? He's one. He doesn't seem to care. And he's like, all right, well, here's a fact. You know, do with it whatever the hell you want to do. Here's one.
And, of course, you know, the only one who I will actually give any credence to and listen to is Lawrence O'Donnell, because Lawrence O'Donnell doesn't shoot his mouth off. He's not screaming and beating the table. And,
right.
And, you know, he's not trying to hang Donald Trump in the court of public opinion. He just wants to get the facts out there to you. You're watching my show, and here's what we know so far.
Exactly.
And how you approach it.
Right. And call out bullshit when it's bullshit. So, all we can do is sit back and hope for more of them and hope that there is that one guy who's going to start digging through and doing the legwork on this. Because, like I said, I get the feeling the wheels are coming off this thing. I just don't know how many lug nuts have already gone. So we'll keep covering it here, of course, and we'll keep covering the rest of pop culture. And we invite you to look around elsewhere on popdose.com, because there's some very talented writers bringing you the world of pop culture in every genre, from TV and movies and books to, of course, the music that we cover here with Rob Ross and more. So do that thing. Click on some of the links on the pages. Enjoy some videos, some music. And Rob, anything in particular we've got in the works for next week?
A lot, actually. A lot of good things. The one thing I really want to focus on next week is Keith Crichton's latest column. It's incredibly powerful. It is incredibly moving. It hit me in a very personal way. I think everybody needs to read what he has written.
Yeah.
Not just this one, but the previous one. And this is something I think we should talk about next week.
We will.
In depth.
We will indeed. And, you know, Keith's a guy who, again, he feels a lot. And you get that through reading the words that are on the page. So there's plenty of emotion that goes along with it. Do that thing. And, Rob, we'll look forward to it. Talk to you next week. Thanks a lot for doing the Radio City bit with us again. And it's always a good time.
Well, it's opening week for baseball. Tomorrow night is also the final game of the NCAA season. Go North Carolina.
Yep.
And hockey season is going to be wrapping up, thank God, because the Rangers just look like shit. So we'll have a lot to talk about next week, even on a fun front like sports.
That's right. And, you know, the Sabres ending the season on a high note, even though not nearly high enough to get them into the playoffs. But Jack Eichel's looking pretty good. So looking forward to next year there as well. We'll do that thing. Radio City, again, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you each week, bringing you just this, some more talk about things that are going on. So join us for it next week. And we hope you had a good time.